This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Hi there, this is Henrik. Greetings to everyone interested in freedom of thought and freedom of opinion. This is Red Ice Radio, the program dedicated to encouraging you to think for yourself and come to your own conclusions. We do not consider it to be our task to do the reasoning for you and then present only what we consider to be the so-called truth. We do consider it to be our task to offer you different sides of the argument or a dissenting opinion, one that questions the established point of view, an option that challenges the popular belief, so that in this juxtaposition, if you will, you can make a decision for yourself. Or maybe you're simply interested in hearing different sides of the arguments. Not everything is about taking sides. You can simply listen because you're interested in learning new things. And I do believe that we can learn something from both those we agree and disagree with as well. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com, the websites where you can learn more. Joseph Atwill is an independent scholar who has set the world of New Testament scholarship in a new direction. In his book, Caesar's Messiah, Atwill outlines the series of events in Jesus' ministry that are parallels with the events of the battle campaign of Titus Flavius. His research has been made into a documentary. Through interviews with seven controversial Bible scholars, the Caesar's Messiah documentary shows that Christianity was invented by the Romans as a political tool to control the masses of the day, and is still being used this way today. Producer-director of the film, Fritz Heed, along with co-producer and writer Niola Sparkis, also join in during this program. And we're going to begin to retrace Joseph's main thesis, including Caesar's possible intentions behind the Gospels. All right, we're going to return today to the topic of Caesar's Messiah today, the documentary this time. We, of course, talked a while back about the book and the follow-up, of course, on this. And today we're going to return to this topic. Very important, very interesting as well. When we have three people with us to talk about this, first of all, we'll say welcome back to Joseph Atwill, the author of this material. How are you today, Joseph? Good to talk to you again.
I'm fine, Henrik, and thank you for having me back.
You bet. It's going to be very interesting. And as well, we're going to say hello first to Fritz Heed, as well as with us, the director. How are you today, Fritz?
Well, really excited to be on this show, Henrik. It's a fantastic show, and we really want to share, you know, what we're doing.
Excellent. Really good. Looking forward to this. And, of course, Nicole Sparkis as well. She is the producer, writer, and the narrator to the film. Hi, Nicole.
Hello, Henrik. I'm very happy to be here as well. Thank you for having us.
Good stuff. Three people. I think that's the most we've had on the show for one, so we'll see how this goes. But we'll speak to one at a time in the beginning here. We'll see how this goes. Okay. No, it's very good. Now, Joseph, why don't we begin with you, though? And for those listeners who are new to this program or just kind of catching up, if you will, and I know this is difficult. We talked about this offline here a little bit, but give us an outline, if you will, of the main thesis about linguistic typology to kind of set the framework here, Joseph.
Sure. Well, the book I wrote simply presents the theory that the Gospels are a particular kind of literature, which, even though it seems to be focused on a character named Jesus Christ, that character is actually a typologic character. In other words, he is designed, everything he does, everything he predicts is about someone else. And this individual is the Son of Man that Jesus predicts will come in 40 years. What I show is that the individual Jesus is predicting as the Son of Man is a Roman Caesar named Titus Flavius. And I show that in the Gospels, there are an enormous sequence, a precise sequence of parallel events between the Gospels character Jesus Christ and the history of the war that Titus Flavius waged against the Jews. So that the Gospels were essentially produced by the Flavians, which is a family of Caesars in Rome in the first century. And they have a kind of inside joke within them, which simply shows that the Son of Man that Jesus was predicting was in fact a Roman Caesar.
Indeed. And we urge people as well, go back into our archives and listen to that first two-hour interview that we did. We went through a lot of the details there and a lot of this stuff, but we'll get into it, obviously, here as well today as we begin talking about the documentary, the film. Now, Fritz, if we turn to you for a moment, when did you come along in all of this? And were you the one who were the driving force behind making the documentary, or how did that happen?
Well, I certainly had an interest in this area. You know, my father had he was an archaeologist in college and basically kept that as a more or less of a hobby. But I grew up in a lot of pyramidal sites in Mexico. And so I always had that kind of interest, but I was always also interested in, you know, what's going on in the world today. And I was doing actually a lot of research into the Old Testament and reading, you know, the works of Ken Humphreys and Achary S and those kind of scholars. And then when I met Joe, I realized that he had a real key to the whole puzzle. And though I'd worked in the film industry for decades, I was more on the side of the post-production and the composition side. I'm a musician, composer, but I was also working with editors and sound design and things like that, and saw a lot of projects run through. So I was pretty confident in a lot of filmmaking abilities, but when I realized what Joe had, I thought, geez, somebody has to make this. And I'd actually tried a few of my friends in the industry, but everybody's busy or they were intimidated by the subject or one thing or another. And I decided, you know, I discussed it with my partner, Neil Lasparkas, and we thought, you know, this is so important. We just have to bring this out. So let's just throw our hat into the ring and give it a shot and make a film on it. So in a sense, I'm a bit of a driving force, but really it's a triumvirate. Really, it's all three of us. We're very, very motivated to get this information out into the public discourse.
Mm. Yeah, and Neil, I recognize your voice right away. I saw the movie myself a while back, and it's very well made. We'll get into that as well with you a little bit, Fritz. But when did you come along then for this project, Neil?
Well, pretty much at the beginning, because Fritz and I both met Joe right at the same time. And he was obviously had a great passion for what he's doing. And it happened to be an interest of mine in the sense that I was raised Catholic. But at around 11 years old, there was some serious hypocrisy that I noticed. And that's when I chose to look for something else for my spiritual inspiration. And so I had been a spiritual seeker ever since then. And when I met Joseph, I still believed that Jesus was a historical figure. Mm-hmm. And I actually set out to edit his book because we wanted to re-release it because he had some additional research. And as I was editing it, I had to read the book, I don't know, gosh, at least five times, I would say, five, six times, something like that,
right,
going over and over it. And everything started sinking in. And of course, it was wonderful to have Joseph right there for me to work with because I could ask him all the questions that I just didn't understand and I wanted to make clearer in the book and so forth. And after 3 years of working with Joe, I am pretty convinced that he has something here that really makes a lot of sense and that Jesus is most likely not a historical figure. So that was a huge shift for me in this process.
You bet. Now, do you recall any of the questions you had, Neola? I mean, I guess you need to be a little bit into the topic to be able to even understand what questions to ask. And I mean, you're right. I mean, when you really go through the material and go through it and go through it again, then you start realizing the impact of it and you understand that, okay, there's a wide dynamic. You open the box, so to speak. So do you recall any of these questions that you had along the way or anything else?
Well, you know, it was always for greater clarification. And I have to admit that history was not one of my great subjects. And so I had to learn a lot of history. Who are the Flavians? I mean, I don't know if there are that many Americans who even know who the Flavian Caesars are. What was the setup of the historical powers right then with the Herods being the tax collectors in Judea? I mean, being raised Catholic, I never knew that they weren't even Jewish, you know. They were not Jewish powers in Judea. And also the Alexanders in Egypt, I didn't understand how they fit in. And it became very clear that it, you know, with any power base, it takes a lot of collusion, I guess is the word. There has to be many powers that all cooperate with each other in order to create a great movement. And setting Joseph Atwell aside for a second, when we went and interviewed Dr. Rod Blackhurst for the documentary, he came up with the motivation that the Flavians were a new dynasty that were basically overthrowing the previous dynasty, the Julio-Claudians, and they needed some way to legitimize their dynasty. And the creation of this literature was the perfect motivation to serve that purpose too. So it, for me, it was understanding the huge general big picture. How could this evolve? How could this New Testament, these Gospels, actually come about? What was the motivation? How did these powers work together to make it happen? And it was, you know, it was something that really shifted my thinking 180 degrees.
Yeah, and that's always interesting when that happens. And you have to reevaluate the what you've been told, what you've learned, and it's challenging. But it's, I think it's essential that we do that, and we challenge what we both believe and what we think we know. And it's, I mean, it's so essential, so important. Now, Fritz, we've had before, as you might know, on the program, Kenneth Humphreys. We'd had Achoria S. with us, and also obviously we talked with Joseph before. Why don't you run through some of the names of some of the other people in the documentary? And was it you primarily who went after to get these for these people for the film, or was that Joseph Fritz?
Well, it was really a group effort. I think Joseph already had a relationship with Robert Eisenman, which is to me was very impressive because he's such a well known name. He's practically a a rock star in biblical studies, so he was actually the first person we interviewed, and Joseph also had the relationship with Dr. Rod Blackhurst. So he really brought some powerful scholars to the table. I had noticed when I was in Joe's library that he had Ken Humphreys and Achari's books and the. You know, so when he first started telling me about his thesis, I felt a connection that you know he already had that background as well, which I had, and I thought, geez, I frankly never met anybody who had those books. He was the first person I could finally talk to who actually had this understanding. It's actually kind of rare, at least here in the United States.
Definitely, so, I think it's around the world. It's pretty rare that people are into this stuff, unfortunately. But I mean, it's an important thing. What do you see, Fritz? What do you hope to see from a movie like this? I mean, when you put your heart and soul into it and your artwork, what is the outcome? I guess what would be a good scenario for you in this case?
Well, the way I see it is that there's a difference between spirituality and religion. I kind of put a dividing line between those two worlds, and the religion side I see is more dogma and crowd control, and spirituality is more of a personal thing. And I just kind of thought that a lot of the strife that I've seen in history from everything I've read and what's going on even today in the world, you just see this religious conflict. And I couldn't help but wanted to understand why are these beliefs so entrenched? And I mean, the one thing that I started finding was a common denominator even before I met Joe was that the Abrahamic tradition that spawned basically, Judaism and Christianity and Islam all had that common denominator. So that's one of the reasons when I came to Joe, I just finished kind of studying the Old Testament and realizing, wow, this God is pretty ferocious who's in this book. And when you contrast it to, other cultures, I mean, there's so many religions on this planet and so many of them have a lot of beauty and, mysticism and interesting myths. And the Abrahamic ones, to me, I just see it as a bit on the caustic side. And I thought, wow, and these are such predominant religions. And I thought, if there's a way to heal this is to somehow to get understanding. And I could see that there was a lot of other scholars that were, unhinging a bit, the Judaism and Islam from other aspects. Because all these religions, to me, are still, I see them as political constructs, frankly.
That's right. Yeah, they are. And Joseph Ward, this might be another very difficult question, but the conflict that Fritz talked about, what do you see being at the heart of this conflict? How could it arise if we have these common denominators? It seems kind of strange, doesn't it?
It is strange. And one of the useful things about Caesar's Messiah is it actually shows the religious basis of the struggle in the first century. In that struggle, you had a very xenophobic, racially oriented Judaism that was messianic, essentially colonized. And so they organized a rebellion, were able to drive the Romans out of Judea and set up their own nation state. The Roman response was really what was interesting, in that they attempted to have the Jews see them as gods. And if you look at the Gospels as to what they really are, they've taken all of these Jewish prophecies, particularly those regarding a Messiah, someone who would be on the planet with God's power, and they've shaped them to their character, Jesus Christ, and beyond into this Son of Man character that Jesus predicts. So what they're trying to do is to bend the religious literature of the Jews to essentially interpret their prophecies in such a way that their divinity would be preeminent. So going forward in time, I would say that the struggle the conflicts typically have right at their core some of these elements. I don't think that they're hard to see. You need to really be very astute about the historical forces that are in play in these struggles to recognize them, but they are there. This basic struggle is still intact. It's still with us. And, I think as long as these traditions exist, there's going to be strife. I really see very little hope for a world in peace with the Abrahamic traditions in massive force as they are now. I mean, in the Western world, they really are, particularly since Islam has now entered Europe and the United States. I mean, they are the underlying principles, and that really, of course, is, we're seeing it in play this very day in the Mideast, where another war has broken out. It's has a very religious context to it, and frankly, it's depressing to see us as humans just continuing to fall into this trap every day. So I am hoping that with the documentary that the idea that at the very core of these religions is a political fraud, that at the very core is a fraud, that will start to have some influence in culture. And hopefully from there, we can start to move away from all of this warfare.
And I don't know what the common critique would be, Joseph, in this case, but is there anyone that is accusing you of, well, this would unravel the religious construct and you're trying to turn people into to atheists? Is that any thing that people, approach you with?
Right. They always, this always comes up that, and, the only response can be that it's just a lot better to stand on the truth than on fiction. It simply will work a lot better most of the time. Now, there's always going to be exceptions. I mean, obviously, one of the very first experiences I had with a reader of Caesar's Messiah was a Christian woman who was dying of cancer and who had read my book and contacted me personally. And I went through an exchange with her during her entire illness, and it was heartbreaking. And you really do wonder, well, is it a good idea to take faith away from people? Perhaps you just should leave them alone. But at the end of that exchange, we had come to a good place. And I will say that going forward, there will be, as Caesar's Messiah takes hold in culture, which I expect and hope it will, there will be thousands of instances where people will lose something that's valuable to them, something that's useful and good in the way that they communicate to their God through Christianity. But if that is laid at my feet, I also want to have the other side of the equation pointed out as well, which is that, think of all of the times in history that Christianity has been a catastrophe for mankind.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And think of how often it is today a disaster. Think of the pedophile scandals that the Catholic Church is able to orchestrate behind the veneer of Christianity. So I just want balance. I'm willing to take, you know, whatever lumps I'm given for bringing out this information, but I just want people to remember that it's not like Christianity is some kind of box of chocolates in the springtime. I mean, there's always been pain and I'm just to give an example, the feudal system, that wasn't particularly a nice thing to do to the people, was it?
No.
So Christianity has has tremendous amount of negative influence that needs to be dealt with, and with Islam and Judaism, we'll just simply see how those scholars and those adherents of those particular religions respond to this information.
If I may speak to this topic, I'd love to speak to it myself. People are always thinking that Joseph Atwell's thesis means to get rid of anybody's personal spiritual beliefs. And actually, if I may speak for you, Joe, I believe that your interest is historical, to set the history record straight, and then people can have greater clarity. Now, the way that I understand religion, it's pretty much a cultural construct. That's why there are so many different religions, to speak to cultural customs that came up at different times in our history. The issue that Joseph has and that the rest of us have is when these cultural customs are used to control the populace into being convinced to do things like be pro-war in the Middle East, for example, that they wouldn't naturally want to be a part of. I mean, Christianity teaches to not kill, you know, so how do you reconcile that? And yet so many right-wing Christians are trying to promote war in the Middle East to bring on the end times so that Jesus could come back, things like that. So in my personal opinion, if people can find the spiritual truths that I see as being a part of our natural evolution, you know, way back before organized religion, people just looked at nature, observed natural laws, and found the spirit within that. And then if they are clear as to what is historical and what is not historical truth, they can practice their spiritual customs in a way that enhances their lives without being controlled by political powers and without having to believe in myths that are made to appear true in order to control them, but not adhere. In other words, to know that Jesus was not historical does not deny some of the good truths that are written in the book for you to live by.
Exactly. And if it is, I mean, if it's true, if it's a false history we're taught, and if it is indeed is a fair tale that we're given, then I totally agree with that. We have to remove that out of the way to be able to get closer to the truth. It is what it is. And for us to discover some form of true spirituality, even if it's, you know, in the components of Christianity, or if it's not, that is up to each and every one of us. But at the end of the day, it has to be removed out of the way so we can at least get to the truth, definitely.
Exactly. And, you know, Henry, really, we're not really addressing the existence of God at all in our documentary. It's not what we're focused on. You know, we're basically just looking at this particular political construct. It's not theology, it's politics. And you know, people can believe in God, and we certainly don't mean anyone to be an atheist. It's not our intention. It's not our business, frankly.
But yeah, and it's interesting. I really, to me, the most important message from the, you know, uncovering the typologic system that's inside the Gospels is simply to recognize that what the Caesars were doing is interfering with rational thought. They wanted to put this story into people's minds because they knew it could essentially damage their ability to think clearly, so that they would be easier to rule. And when Niola mentions the spiritual activity of humans prior to Christianity, this, in my mind, these spiritual activities would have all been organized around essentially mental clarity. They would have helped people to think more clearly, to understand themselves more clearly, to feel better. There was nothing but essentially they were coming from natural positive attempts to better one's life. Because people went through that process, the rulers were able to understand how the process operated and then use these stories, use religious stories as a way to confuse people. The power of Caesar's Messiah in my dreams would be that it would simply improve the clarity that people think with. They would think more clearly about government. They would be more skeptical. They'd be more objective. They would be more questioning. They wouldn't simply take every single story on face value because someone of authority gave them this information.
Mm-hmm. One of the scholars that I brought into the documentary is Timothy Freke. And together with his partner, Peter Gandy, they had written a book called The Jesus Mysteries. And he spoke about the Gnostic movement that were taking the philosophies, you know, of what you give is what you get back and love your neighbor and things like that. But they knew that the Jesus story was a myth, and the purpose of the myth was transcendence, to die to your lower nature and rise to your higher nature. And I thought that that was an important thing to put in there to address the spiritual aspects of religion, which the rest of the documentary is dealing with the historical facts about what most likely possibly happened during the first century. So I thought that Timothy Freke was an important scholar to bring in to address that.
Absolutely. Now, because some people at this stage, then, Joseph, we'll go back to you, might ask, what does this have to do with anything that's going on today? This is, you know, 2,000 years ago. But again, I want to return to that idea that you mentioned, that if religion is at the heart today of most of the conflicts that we see in the world, then it absolutely has everything to do with today. We see a ramping up effort almost with the with Iran today, war with Iran.
Sure.
Syria, the same. We've seen it in Libya. Yeah.
It couldn't be worse. In the United States, particularly the Book of Revelation is used consistently in the media to subtly essentially make the case that the wars in the Mideast are reasonable. George Bush, when he was attempting to develop a coalition to invade Iraq, this is Junior in 2004, went to the French Prime Minister Chirac and insisted that he join the coalition because the war would be Gog and Magog. Chirac didn't know what Bush was talking about. Following the meeting, he got a Bible scholar who said essentially that the American president seems to be operating as a character from the Book of Revelation. He should have been removed from office. It seems to me that this would be, you know, just prima facie qualifications for insanity. But because Christianity has not been debunked, because it is seen as having some basis in history, then the zany prophecies that are attached to the literature can be presented with a straight face. People don't immediately respond with, you know, a strong negation of it, saying, hey, that's crazy. No one told Bush, evidently, and since this was clearly have been his position among his staff, there was no one in his staff that called him on it. Why is that? Where are the representatives of sanity? The Mideast War is just a absolutely perfect example of what we hope the documentary can prevent. Wars that are presented to the public as reasonable, and part of that rationale is that there is this tradition in Christianity about that this is a good war. And the Book of Revelation, it states that you have this big apocalyptic war in the Middle East, following which you have the return of Jesus. We have just millions of Christians in the United States that believe that this is true.
Now, but there's no way out of this situation. If they're tied to these scriptures that prophesy this, Oh, it's almost like there's no way out. I know that you have another take on this, Joseph. I want to get to that. But what's your comment on that?
Well, I think you're right. I think that this is the problem, which is why, you know, the debunking of the literature will not. I mean, in other words, if Christianity is widely understood by a huge fraction of the population as being a myth, this won't necessarily stop people who are currently Christians from believing in the negative aspects of the myth and being led astray by politicians. They'll still be very vulnerable because that they will be having the effect of the literature that was intended. In other words, the Gospels are intended to end the reader's ability to think clearly. But what I'm hoping is that not so much that those kinds of Christians will convert. I think, as you say, that they're essentially impossible to reach. What I'm hoping is that the people who know better, who can think more clearly, will not stand by there silently and accepting this irrationality. That when they because and on the grounds that it's impolite to question someone's faith. What I'm hoping is that if the understanding of how the religion operates and what it was designed for and how the minds of the Christians have been essentially damaged, that once these ideas are in the hands of the secular, hopefully clearer thinking people, that they will be more aggressive, they will stand up in a firmer stance to oppose crazy ideas that come from those people.
You know, we have a presidential election coming up this fall in America, and there are so many. Religion has been a huge part of the primary, especially the Republican Party that is traditionally known to be more right-wing Christian. And there is a huge movement in America right now to get religious people to vote according to their religion, and to vote for a candidate that is perceived to be religious. So if our film humbly can bring some awareness to the lack of historicity and that religion is a cultural choice, not a fact of history, then perhaps that will even determine a different outcome for the election this fall.
And interestingly enough, I remember this from CBS News, not last year, 2009, stated that Obama actually invokes Jesus more often than Bush did, which says that this is across the board. And again, we're back to that situation. Either they really believe this themselves, or they're just playing on this.
They play on it.
Yeah,
I think so? He has to do that because so many people think he's Muslim. Well, I guess Muslims believe that in Jesus too. You know,
Of course they do. Yeah. I think that democracy in the United States is broken. There are a number of reasons for this, but certainly one of them is just that there's such a large fraction of people who are so easily fooled by rulers that use the mask of Christianity. That's one of the problems. And the idea that the documentary might change the election, it's sort of an odd idea to me. I don't think either candidate is really representing any sort of an independent choice. They're both beholden to the oligarchs. So what I would be hoping is that it would make people aware that they aren't being given any choices. That they can essentially vote on slave issues like same-sex marriage. Or abortion, but in terms of the real financial structure or the foreign policy involving the military, I mean, those both candidates have exactly the same position, and so we really don't have a choice here in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. The elite, the oligarchs, as you said, Joseph, they run the politics in America today and decide, it seems like, which way to go and how America should spend its money, and more and more money is being spent on the military as well. So again, this is not something that's ramping down. The question is here, and I've talked with other people about this, if there's any way out of the Book of Revelations, if you will, or if this is another encoded message, if you will, because we're dealing with mind control here, after all. That's what religion is. And so people are so instilled on this idea that there has to be there has to be a war. This has to play out for this to fulfill, as you said, Joseph. But in your view, the second coming and all that has already happened. Is that something that, that could contribute to diffuse a potential situation like this?
Oh, boy, I hope so. One of the really wonderful things about the documentary is that it makes it very clear that the concept of the second coming, which has befuddled Christians for thousands of years, can be explained very clearly. The Son of Man that Jesus is predicting in the Gospels, who's going to come with all of this destruction, this is a Roman Caesar. He came. The second coming has already occurred. The prophecies have already taken place, and so we can simply put the concept aside. That's the Gospels. Now, in the book of Revelation, it's actually a different strand of typology, and I have another book coming out which will explain it, but just in a nutshell, following Titus Flavius's death, this was the individual that helped produce the Gospels and who was the Son of Man that Jesus predicted. Titus's brother, Domitian, became Caesar, and he created a zany typologic character we know as the Apostle Paul, and a zany book of prophecies called the Book of Revelation. And in fact, if you know how to read typology, based on the genre that Titus created in the Gospels, you can see that the second coming that the Revelation refers to, or the coming in the future, is simply about Domitian. And so there's actually two second comings that the New Testament references. One is the one in the Gospels, and the other is the one in the Book of Revelation. Well, they've both already occurred. No one needs to worry about this. Anyone, I would say, in a powerful position in the media that is putting forward apocalyptic ideas at this point is either really a sick individual or has a hidden agenda. In other words, that they're simply putting these ideas out there in order to have the populations more readily accept the insane wars in the Mideast, because as you mentioned, mind control is a specialty of the oligarchs, and that's another thing that I hope that the documentary really does help the population see more clearly, is that the people who rule us really do know an awful lot about our psychology. They really do, and they are able to very subtly shift our mind so that we do not recognize what is in our interests and instead see as reasonable what the oligarchs want. And this the way that the apocalypse has slipped into the American media consciousness in the last couple years as a device to normalize the invasion of the Middle East, it just couldn't be a clearer example. It just couldn't be clearer. So whenever these apocalyptic movies or stories come out or documentaries, people should always be thinking about whether or not there is an agenda behind them. And yet they seldom do. And I'm hoping that that the work that we've done in a documentary will just help people be more skeptical about these things, be more resistant to the mind control.
You bet. Now, Old Testament, New Testament, where can we put the Flavians into the picture here? And I'm not sure they actually responsible for when it comes to the scriptures, is it all of it, Joseph, or just certain books of the New Testament?
Well, they wrote the New Testament. The New Testament, the term actually means New Covenant. And what it actually refers to is that Moses established a covenant between God and the Jews. And this had an enormous body of literature that was associated with it. The Flavians decided that they would create a new covenant. And their historian, their court historian, Josephus, specifically recorded this. He actually stated that the covenant that God had with the Jews was ended, and the new covenant was going to go to the Flavians. So this was the new covenant that the Romans developed. Jesus Christ, he simply predicted everything that was going to happen during the war, The war would be essentially the final end between the covenant of between the Jews and the Romans. And from the Romans' perspective, they would now be the chosen people. They would now have all of the prophecies and the Torah flowing into their imperial power, so they could then use it to control the region that the religion existed in. This was an old trick. If you look on how the Caesars controlled, even for example, Alexandria, they would come in and take on the identities of the local gods. They wouldn't simply worship them; they would essentially become the new god, the local gods. And so, this was what the Flavians did. This was why they had a new covenant established. Why it's called the New Covenant, and it's actually, in some ways, when you look at it, it's actually quite absurd that this hasn't been widely understood before, because the title that they gave the head of the new covenant, the Pontiff Maximus, is in fact a title of Caesar. It's not some original title. It's literally one of Caesar's title. And the home of the new covenant, the Vatican, well, this was the imperial palace. I mean, they didn't even move or change their name. They simply stayed put and organized this religion. So it's really time that Christianity was exposed, and it's time that the citizens began to stand up against these techniques. And it's time, as Neola mentioned, that we attempt to connect to a spirituality that is actually organic and not one that's being imposed.
Yeah, that's right, by external forces, as it were. Now, I want to hear if there's anyone, Neola or Fritz, that want to add anything to what Joseph just talked about here.
Well, Ken Humphreys put it very beautifully in our film when he said that the imperial cult that was set up to worship Caesar, and the Flavian Caesars knew that this was a good method of ruling, because the Julio-Claudians had done it for 150 years before they came on the throne. So there was already an imperial cult set up to worship Caesar, and it was a pagan cult. They worshipped so many different gods, but Caesar was a god, and everybody throughout the empire had to worship Caesar as a god. And of course, the Jews in Judea just were the ones that would not allow a statue in their temples, a statue of Caesar, because they didn't allow statues. They didn't allow any graven images at all. So what they did, Ken Humphreys says, they just changed their uniform a little bit. They wore different hats. They had the same robes. They had the title of Pontifex Maximus, which is still taken by the Catholic Pope today. He is known as the Pontifex Maximus. It's written on the Vatican. It could not be more clear that this is the way that the religion evolved. And Timothy Freke also makes a point in the documentary that so many of the current Catholic churches are built upon the old pagan churches. And so it is seen as the new rule, the new way of controlling the populace. And even the Alexander family that was the Roman tax collectors in Egypt, one of their relatives was already writing a philosophy that combined Judaism with paganism, and that is where Christianity took a lot of its teachings from. This was definitely an operation to try to defang the Jewish religion and combine it with what the Romans perceived as the modern spirituality, which was the Greek and Roman paganism. And they used it to worship Caesar and to make the Jews worship Caesar in a way that they wouldn't know that they were doing it.
I mean, I've said this before, but I mean, just look at the calendar stuff as well. The Julian calendar, Julius Caesar, he brought it in what, 46 or so, I think, and just resetting it, making it year zero. I mean, that's a pretty big message right there. Fritz, what do you think about that?
It is.
I mean, why do they do that? Why is that an important thing, do you think, to me, it's like you push the reset button in a way, and it's like, okay, from now on out, it's our rule. We have now almost effectively anyway, taken over, or we're going to try to attempt to do so from this point. It's pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, very, very much so. I don't know if that was an intention or not. I haven't researched that particular point, but certainly looking back at it, that period of time is what our entire history is anchored to at this point.
That's right.
And you know what's interesting about that is that the dating of our years is actually focused entirely on Flavian military victory. Because the way you get the year zero is in the prophecy of Daniel, you have a thing called the 70 weeks. So this is where the number 70 comes from. Jesus's ministry was between 30 and 33 because he is essentially the Passover lamb of the new covenant. You know, you have the Last Supper where you have his body is offered as a Passover lamb. Well, the Passover, you think about it, the old Passover took place in a 40-year cycle. This was the typical cycle that the Jews operated in within the Old Testament. And so there was 40 years between the first Passover and when they could go into the promised land. Well, in the New Covenant, you have 33 Passover at 33. Then 40 years to the day, to the very day, is 73 Passover. Hmm. Passover the year 73. And that's the year that's the day that the war ends with the fall of Masada. So you can see that the number 70 was really what began our dating system. That was the point that the Flavians oriented. If you actually just do the arithmetic, you'll see that you can't do it any other way. They picked that orientation very precisely to have the 40-year cycle and a 70-year number existing, so they could essentially be kind of, remember, this is the new covenant. So they're showing that these magic numbers that exist in the Torah also are existing within their battles.
Hmm.
It's a typological parallel.
Yeah.
Now, the question is there, that's very interesting because they borrowed, and we talked briefly about this last time as well, Joseph, but with Josephus, the Alexandrians and other who are Jews at the time, the question is, did the Romans, did they take it over? Did they hijack this? Or again, did these Jewish people who began working with the Romans at this stage basically hand it over to them, this knowledge? That's a big question for me anyway. What do we say to that, Joseph?
Well, they had the premier Jewish intellectual family of the time on the payroll, the Alexanders. Philo was the most famous Jewish intellectual of that entire century. He knew the scriptures backwards and forwards. He knew the prophecy structure. He knew the typology. He developed the concept of logos as it's understood in the Gospels. So they had the technical ability to write the Gospels through the Alexanders. And the Alexanders aren't just some run-of-the-mill Jewish tax-collecting family. They were the wealthiest family in the world at that time. And when they stood, and they by that I mean when they accepted the Flavians as the new Caesar, this was a very dangerous act. They were the very first family to make a public statement accepting the Flavians as Caesar and ending the Julio-Claudian line.
And do we know why? Do we know why they did this?
Yeah, they did it because they saw the Julio-Claudians as decadent. You have to think of Caligula, Nero, Claudius.
Right.
And none of those Caesars were able to get the rebellion crushed, which was damaging their financial interests. The Alexander family is recorded as having killed 50,000 Messianic Jews in the city of Alexandria in the years before the rebellion broke out. 50,000. So you can see that this family simply wasn't getting the leadership from Rome that it thought was necessary to maintain their financial interests. And the Flavians, who were nothing but military leaders, they had been fighting the Druids for the decade before Nero brought them into Judea to put down the Messianic rebellion. The Alexanders knew the Flavians well. They had a very long-standing relationship with them. It goes back several generations. They knew each other. They had financial interests. And they actually had romantic linkages between them. So they were very, very comfortable with each other. When the Alexander's decided to leave the Julio-Claudians behind and to establish the Flavian Caesarship, they proclaimed the Flavian Caesar as God. And this is critical. And incidentally, this is not conjecture. The document still exists. They actually refer to a human as God. Now, this shows that they had completely abandoned the Jewish religion. They may have been ethnically Jews, but their worldview was completely secular and financially driven.
Right.
And so they looked at the Messianic Rebellion as simply a financial threat and a threat to their power. They looked to the Flavians as the solution. So when the Flavians wanted to essentially get rid of the Messianic movement, or at least put a competing body of literature into history to try to slow the real Messianic movement down, this was the motivation that the Alexanders had. It was it couldn't be any stronger. They were literally fighting for their financial and political lives, and had thrown everything in with the Flavians, and therefore the idea of making the Flavian the son of man or the Christ, it would have just been automatic. There wouldn't have been any question whatsoever that this would that this was a good idea. And just of note is the fact that the tax-collecting family directly to the north of the Alexanders were the Herods. The Herods had been trying to breed a Christ for generations. They had been taking brides that were Maccabean. This was the Messianic family that the Romans had kicked out when they took over the country. The Herods couldn't get the local Jews to essentially accept them as king, or because they had this religious problem. So they took over for generations. They would take Maccabean brides, have children, and then try to present the child as a legitimate king of the Jews. But the Jews wouldn't buy this. So really, if you look at the Gospels, they are simply the combination of these two projects. One is you have the Herod's Breed a Christ program that failed. And down below, you have literary efforts by the Alexanders to try to create a tame version of the Jewish scriptures. Well, you put those two together and you've got Jesus Christ.
It's a very, very intriguing story. And it's almost then, maybe it's a crude analogy to make, but if we look at the Alexanders as the Rothschilds of the time, I mean, is this an equal partnership in your view, Joseph, or if anybody else want to comment on this, or does one own the other or have more power over the other family here?
Oh, gee, I can't imagine that the Alexanders were as evil as the Rothschilds.
All right, yeah. But in the context of the... Go ahead, Fritz.
You have the money on one side, but the military power that Rome had was awesome at the time. So I think the merger of those two energies, you know, made it pretty irresistible for them to succeed.
The Flavians were the top warriors for decades before they came into power as emperors. They were fighting all of the battles under Nero. They were out in expanding the empire. They totally annihilated the Druids in the Celtic lands and destroyed their history so thoroughly that we barely know anything about the Druids. And that's a direct result of the Flavians. And so you have this political, this military might with the Flavians. Now, the Vespasian and Titus, the two main Caesars, they came from the working class ranks. So they really had the respect of the people. They had the respect of the soldiers. They won over the Romans. They were popular. They were much more popular than Nero, who was obviously bankrupting the empire. And so the Alexanders provided the money. The Herods provided the control of Judea and the messianic breeding that Joseph was talking about. And so the three families together, you know, it was just a great... They each brought something special to the power that made it all happen the way it did. And it's lasting to this day, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I wanted to return to my comment on the Rothschilds just for a second. You know, it isn't really, I really misspoke. It isn't a question so much of evil. It's a question of technique. And if you look at the technique the oligarchs have today, And the Rothschilds, I think, would be, you know, in that category. They just have borrowed a lot of technique from the Caesars. And so to my mind, when people look at Caesar's Messiah, and particularly those who kind of get it, and I know a large fraction of people who read the book, and I think a far larger fraction of people who see the documentary, they're just going to get it. They're just going to come out of the theater and they're going to go, yeah, that's what happened. That's correct. What you're really seeing is just a technical device. It's just a way that people who have power maintain it. And so since power and wealth are not equally distributed, the citizens who do not have enough need to look on the wealthy not so much as evil. I don't think this is a good or clear way to look at them. They probably have the same motivations as any person. It's just that they have the technique to keep themselves in power. That's all Christianity was ever developed to be. It's simply a technique to keep a small group in power. So what is the response? Hopefully it's that people who recognize what Christianity was will look upon those who are powerful with more skepticism. They won't be fooled so easily.
Yeah, it becomes an analogy of what's going on today.
And of course, Joe, you are a master chess player. So obviously, Joe has got this keen eye that he can recognize strategy. That is how he saw the parallels in the New Testament.
He's a puzzle solver.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like puzzle. So the way that they constructed the Gospels had a lot of logical puzzles in it and these complicated literary puzzles, which, you know, if you sort of have a background and as a hobby of puzzle solving, they're irresistible. I think that actually the Gospels will be read a lot more frequently in the coming years by people who actually become charmed by the puzzles that are actually inside them. It's just amazing that they haven't been noticed before, but it just shows you that if you don't recognize the genre, the basic genre of the literature you're reading, you just can't grasp the nuance that the author intended.
Now, interestingly enough, Professor Rod Blackhurst from Australia, he teaches at La Trobe University, he arrived at the same conclusion that Joseph Atwell did. They didn't know each other. They didn't work together. They didn't read each other's works. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Blackhurst is an expert in ancient Roman literature. And he says, if you know the Roman literature of the day, you will see the exact same puzzles, the exact same games that you can recognize in the gospel. So if you know that literature, you will recognize this as, it's just another one of those.
That's really fascinating. Yeah. Now, go ahead, Fritz.
No, I was going to say, you know, the main difference between his thesis and Joe's, you know, Joe's relies on the typology of the parallels, but Rod Blackhurst, he was looking at it more of the context and of what was going on at the time period and looking at the motivation of all the characters. And that's frankly the way we structured our documentary, because I think it's a little easier for a person to understand, you know, when you understand who the characters are, and you put them in the context of what was going on, and then you can predict what they would probably do in that circumstance. It's a little more the human connection of you know, motivations and that kind of thing that you can understand it from. You know, the what Joe, of course, has with the parallels is that it becomes what I kind of always thought was kind of the smoking gun in a sense of saying, well, you know, you see these 40-some parallels and they just can't be by coincidence. The laws of probability are outrageous. So he brought some real bedrock to the thesis. So, you know, Rod Blackhurst had a great thesis, but Joe brought this component that really grounds it.
Yeah, the Romans want the legacy. The Flavians want the immortal legacy for having created Christianity. And so they intended that the Gospels essentially be decoded. If the Gospels had been like massively redacted, then all of this typology would have disappeared, because it's dependent on the events of the ministry of Jesus being in the same sequence that the history of the war that Flavius Josephus recorded are in. So you have this connection between two groups of literary works, and if one of them had been massively changed, then they just wouldn't link up perfectly to the other one. So that's why the version that's been handed down was the one that actually more or less was produced in the first century.
Now, it's very interesting stuff. We're going to take a short break here at this point between our two segments, carry on in the next one. Let's give out the websites here, though. We need to do that. We also need to talk a little bit about release dates of the DVD. It's not yet out yet, and it's has a premiere upcoming soon. So whoever wants to jump on this and give us the information, please go ahead and do so.
Okay, I'll jump in there. Well, the date right now we have is September 28th. And it's going to be, basically, that's a theatrical release in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills. And it's going to run there for a week. And we're going to release at the same time on Amazon.com. You can stream it or download it. And the DVDs and Blu-rays. And it will also be available on our website, which is CaesarsMessiahDoc.com. There's a new platform called Distrify. And there'll be a player on the site that you'll be able to go directly right to our website and actually stream the movie or download it right from there.
And is that on the same date? Will it be released as well?
Yeah. We're synchronizing everything at this point to the 28th of September.
Yeah. So we're a few months away. And the premiere, any anticipation about that? I know you guys are working on trying to get mainstream media, I guess, kind of cracking and opening their eyes a little bit to this as well. How's that going?
Exactly. Well, that's our job right now, you know, is the marketing and publicity. And we do have a press agent who's helping us. And, you know, our hope is to basically to rattle the cages out there a bit. And, you know.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that we went to a premiere in a theater in a major city is that there is just something both irresistible and demanding a response about a marquee with Caesar's Messiah, the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus. It just makes a statement that should elicit a questioning from the media. There will be enough people wondering about it that the thesis will get, and hopefully the documentary will get some questioning in the mainstream media, and this will lead to a real penetration of culture.
Yeah, we're hoping for really a brush fire, if not a firestorm.
And we are not allowed to divulge, but our press agent has said that we have a few celebrities attending, so
maybe Hollywood this is an interesting topic to them, perhaps. Who knows?
Well, we're actually hoping to have both presidential candidates.
Oh, boy.
Or perhaps Mel Gibson, if he's listening.
Yeah, that's right. We'll see how that goes. Now, let's take a little break here, guys, and we'll carry on in the next segment. So thank you for this first one. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more.
Now who'd you think besides yourself was a pick of a crop? Buddha, was he where it's at? Is he where you are? Could Mohammed move a mountain, or was that just the odds? You give me silence, that was not a mistake. Oh, did you know your message that would be a record breaker?
In the second hour, we'll discuss literary techniques used by the Romans that will explain Titus' typology and reversal of the Gospels. He also reveals the logic puzzle at the last four Gospels. Later, we talk about the need for new myths. Also, we discuss what method of thought can set us free from doctrine. I hope you stay with us. To learn more, go to redicemembers.com and read more about how to subscribe and acquire a membership if you want to continue listening to this or any of our previous programs. We have more intriguing and insightful guests coming up on Red Eyes Radio. Full guest list in our radio archive. We have Lark and Rose next up, a very interesting program on government, statism, and much more. But we'll return with more in the second hour together with Atwill, Heed, and Sparkus.